You're listening to the Inverse Podcast, where we explore how the scriptures can turn our world upside down,
or how it can be weaponized to uphold the status quo. I'm Drew Hart.
And I'm Jared McKenna, and this is Inverse.
Hey friends, we're really excited about our next episode. This is going to be amazing, and I think it's going to be really thought-provoking and challenging. And so I'm excited to introduce our guest for today. We have with us Anthony Lowenstein, who is an independent journalist, best-selling author, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. He's written for The Guardian, The New York Times, The New York Review of Books, and many others. And his latest book, which is really provocative and challenging and really important, is called The Palestine Laboratory: How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. His other books include Pills, Powder, and Smoke, Disaster Capitalism, and My Israel Question. His documentary films include Disaster Capitalism and the Al Jazeera English films, West Africa's Opioid Crisis and Under the Cover of COVID. And he was based in East Jerusalem from 2016 to 2020. And so, as you can already imagine with that bio, that this is going to be a really important conversation. So, Anthony, welcome to Inverse Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited. Let's do this.
Yeah, mate, congratulations first off on a bestseller in New Zealand already, It's just been released. Before we get to your text, thanks for hanging out with us God botherers. It's probably appropriate for us to start with our sacred text. And despite the fact that you identify as a Jewish atheist, you've been kind enough to step into our world and choose a text. So which text from the Jewish Christian canon are you going to share with us as we get going?
This one is from Ecclesiastes, and the post, or the segment, I should say, is, "There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to tear down and a time to build." It's short and it's sweet, and actually in many ways it reminds me, I grew up, which we might talk about or not, in a Jewish family in Melbourne in Australia. And although we were never religious, we used to go to synagogue semi-regularly, Jewish holidays, etc. And a passage like that, I don't know if that particular one was read, but something similar, I do recall from my childhood. And actually, I found it moving then, and I still find it moving now. Obviously, it can be interpreted in a thousand ways.
That's right.
But yeah.
Yep, that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, we will definitely look forward to hearing your thoughts on that particular text. I'm not sure where you're going, and that's what it makes it exciting. But I'd be really curious, and you kind of already started to hint at this, but like, when do you first remember encountering the Bible? Did any stories come to mind, memories come to mind?
Well, let me briefly say, so I grew up in Melbourne in the 70s. I was born in 74, so I'm 50 next year, which is shocking, but there you go. And I grew up in a liberal Jewish home. And for those who don't know what that means, it means that religion was not the center of our lives. Israel was not the center of our lives. I'll get to Israel in a minute, because for many Jewish people, Israel has become, I would argue, a center of their life. And I think for many Jewish people, in fact, it's replaced their religion. Yeah. In fact, many Jews, I mean, it's hard to generalize, there are around 15 million Jews around the world now, which is a pretty small population, really. And pretty much half are in Israel and half are in the US. I mean, obviously, there's Jews in Europe and Australia and elsewhere, but in general, Jews are in two places now, Israel and the US. And for many, many Jewish people, particularly since Second World War, of course, and the establishment of Israel 75 years ago, Israel has become a key part of their life and often has replaced religion. For many Jews who are secular, Israel has become their religion, and we can talk about that in a minute. But when I was growing up, you know, my family were refugees from Europe, came in 1939, fairly typical Jewish story, who were trapped in Europe, realized too late about what was happening in Nazi Germany. Most could not get out, most got trapped, and most were killed in the Holocaust. And the ones who did get out in 39 came to Australia, US, UK, wherever would take them. And many people will know many countries did not want to take many Jews. Yeah. I would say, based on fairly anti-Semitic views of many Western governments back then. Anyway, so they came in 39 to Australia. And when I was growing up, as I said, Israel was never the center of my life. But it was always said that, God forbid something happens again. For those who don't know, as a Jew, I can go to Israel tomorrow. And if I can prove that I'm Jewish, my mother is Jewish, it goes through the mother's line, I can become a citizen within 2 or 3 months. Whereas Palestinians, who have, in my view, far more connection to the land, do not have that same right. That's partly why I never took up that option. So I don't have an Israeli passport. So I guess I discovered the Bible or was hearing about it. I went to a non-Jewish school, but I went to Sunday school, which was basically training me, so to speak, for a bar mitzvah when I was 13. Again, the liberal synagogue, that meant mostly in English, but I would, you know, the Torah was in Hebrew. Some very, very liberal synagogues in the US do everything in English now. Yeah. Which is obviously a bit easier for someone who doesn't speak Hebrew. But anyway, so I learned a bit of Hebrew. But yes, I mean, the Bible was never obviously the center part of my life. But I mean, the general values within it then and now are ones that I share. I think I would argue most people share across religions or those who are atheists.
Anthony, I'm fascinated around how you experienced the actual text. Were they... texts, even if they were in the background or slightly to the side of the life in home, were they texts that you could sense a liberative energy, or were they texts in which there was an oppressive reality to them? Would you speak a little bit to the complexities of those different streams that often flow through religious communities and people's hermeneutics as they approach sacred texts, and how you saw them as a kid?
Yeah. I didn't see them as oppressive. They certainly were not oppressive to me or my family. I don't think, it's hard to generalize, but I think the majority of liberal Jews, for want of a better expression, do not see religious texts as oppressive. Obviously, there are certain more religious Jews in Israel and elsewhere who may interpret things in ways that I would find offensive, problematic, racist, whatever you want to say. But when I was growing up, I think the Bible was, as I said, my parents did not want to send me to a Jewish school because their theory was that it would make my education too narrow. So the only exposure I had was, I guess, yes, we every Friday night would light the candles on the Sabbath, say a few prayers over the wine, over the bread, would go to synagogue of Jewish holidays, Yom Kippur, which just happened, Jewish New Year. Sorry, Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year. Yom Kippur is shortly, which is the Day of Atonement. I think we used to always fast for the day. For those who don't know, Jews are supposed to fast for the day, and you have things like, you know, reflect on the year that's been, reflect on what's happening, where things are going. I would argue much of that is abused in many ways, which I can get to if you want. I mean, abused in the context of Israel. Both within Israel itself and also in the Jewish diaspora. But no, for me, I think growing up, I never saw the Bible as oppressive. Again, it was never a massive presence in my life. But in Sunday school, which when I guess I was with kids who were, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, we would sometimes talk about passages in the Torah, I guess in Hebrew, but then translate into English to sort of explain certain, I mean, you know, general values, being good to your neighbor, all the sort of, when I say the cliches, I don't mean that in a bad way, but, you know, all the general things that many of us, I believe now to this day. I guess I was never particularly turned on to being a religious person. And again, that's fairly common in the Jewish community. Of course, there's a religious aspect to Jews. Of course, there is. Both in the Jewish diaspora and in Israel. And in fact, the Jewish birth rate in those communities are way, way higher than in the secular liberal Jewish community, which of course is skewing, I would argue, much of the politics in a way that I find very problematic. Generally more conservative, generally much more pro-Israel, in my view, often generally more racist towards Palestinians. Obviously, I'm generalizing here, there are exceptions. But in general, and I think to me, that's really caused a great deal of a chasm. And that's partly what has turned me off Judaism in a way, which we can talk about if you'd like.
Yeah, no, this is good. I think it's helpful to have these differentiations. But you mentioned something which I think is pretty astute, which I'm always trying to get my students to consider. So I teach theology at MSI University. And students will say, the Bible says blah, 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 rather than they interpret the Bible to say, and that there's a lot of different interpretations, right?
For sure.
And so you mentioned the word interpretation, but I'd be curious, as you've kind of seen some of the more, I think you use the language of narrow and maybe even harmful interpretations of scriptures, as you can also see ways that these texts can encourage care for neighbors and those who are most vulnerable. What would you say from your own experience, from how you've processed how people read scriptures, what you would hope people would keep in mind, right, as they're reading these texts, for folks that these texts are normative and central for their lives, what might you like encourage them to consider as they interpret the text?
Well, that it was written at a time where the world was virtually unrecognizable to the world we live in now. And it was written, obviously, by people who, I mean, assuming one believes it was written by humans. I mean, maybe some people on this conversation don't believe that. But, I mean, you know, it was written by people in a radically different time with different values. I mean, some of the values, yes, are similar, caring for your neighbor, et cetera. But, of course, let's be frank here. Caring for your neighbor, until relatively recently, for many people, did not mean people of color, for example. Mm. It often did not mean lots of women. It often did not mean, now I'm generalizing, but it often did not mean, for example, in the Jewish community, Palestinians. It just did not. And again, there are many people who did not have that view then and now when I was growing up in the 70s. But that ability to interpret as meaning, well, it means supporting your neighbor as long as they're not X, Y, or Z. Now, of course, that caveat is often not mentioned, but that's the practical reality, because I used to hear often justification for Israeli actions through the Bible. The Bible says X, the Torah preaches us to believe in Y, and therefore that's why Israel has to do such and such to Palestinians, why Israel has to occupy. I mean, not that many Jews would even use the word occupation, which to me is insane. But though you find some other way to describe it. So look, I think in a general sense, it's very possible to view the Bible as a text which can be interpretive and learned and inspirational, as long as that understanding and context is given. And also, as you guys would know very well, can be profoundly abused to justify God knows what in God knows where. I mean, a lot of my work over the years has been in Palestine, but also done lots of work in Africa as a journalist. And I saw regularly, I lived in South Sudan in 2015, which people might know as now the world's newest nation. Very self-described Christian nation, although I would question how often that's interpreted there. And often you had very hardline American churches going into South Sudan, other places nearby, to try to push or pressure South Sudanese and their neighboring countries in a what I would call a very discriminatory, hardline, violent way, which to me is a very damaging way of how the Bible can be used and abused. And I often see this, finally, I often see that those groups doing that because they feel in certain ways that the battle has been lost in the West in much of those conversations, whether it's gay rights, trans rights, women's rights, whatever it may be. Whereas in parts of Africa, not everywhere, but in certain parts, it's seen as so-called virgin ground. And I think that's very problematic, to put it mildly.
Yeah, no kidding. Anthony, I'm so aware of the nuance in which you speak of the realities of Israel-Palestine, particularly when I think those on the left, or people more broadly of compassion, when considering these things, often take a step back if they're not part of the Jewish community, because they fear the ongoing anti-Semitism, which is on the rise again in so many parts of the world, and how to talk about these realities and the realities of occupation and apartheid state that has this incredible positive impact in most people's imagination, that it's a story of inspiration, not a story of horror. You're fascinatingly able to differentiate between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitic sentiment, propaganda, and policies. For those of us who aren't Jewish, even if some of our relatives are, how can we, with integrity, talk about the reality of what our Palestinian sisters and brothers and siblings are going through without falling into anti-Semitism? Would you speak to some of that?
Yeah.
And well, can I add one more? Because you mentioned anti-Judaism. And so maybe put all three of those in there because I think they should all be. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. Well, anti-Semitism, the way I interpret it, I think is generally accepted, which is actual Jew hatred that could be expressed these days through literally attacking Jews physically. In the last year, some people will be aware there's been a real spate of that, for example, in parts of New York and Brooklyn against religious Jews who are visibly Jewish, you know, with the big hats and the coats and all that kind of thing. That to me, if you're attacking a Jew for because they look a certain way, it's anti-Semitism pretty uncontroversially. If you are saying as an individual online or in person horrible things about Jews controlling the world, about all that rhetoric, which I might add someone like Elon Musk and his dear friends is flirting with a lot at the moment, which deeply disturbs me for someone with such massive power and influence. I don't know if he realizes it. I don't think he's a stupid person. As an example, but I think he's very happy to flirt with those kinds of ideas. I don't think his particularly understanding of history is particularly good. He's obviously a brilliant businessman on one level. I mean, not that I like a lot of his philosophies,
his practice.
You know. So anti-Semitism in some parts of the world, you're right, Jared, is growing. There's no doubt actual anti-Semitism, attacks against Jews physically or online. But for many of the Jewish groups, particularly that are doing that accounting, looking at how many Jews are being attacked and where they're being attacked, they increasingly are deliberately conflating anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. Now, anti-Zionism is very, very different. Anti-Zionism, and I call myself an anti-Zionist, is someone who does not believe in the concept of a Jewish state. The Zionist is someone who believes that Jews have the right to a homeland. Obviously, it is currently in the Middle East. I mean, in theory, it could be someone else, somewhere else. And
it was nearly here in Australia, right?
Indeed. It's crazy.
People forget. It's
such a crazy history, which I don't want to digress too much. But yes, there are investigations in the last 100 years to Argentina, parts of Australia. I mean, the idea that you would have a Jewish state in the middle of Australia is kind of crazy. would have caused its own problems, to put it mildly. Anyway, but yes, I mean, you can be a Zionist and not necessarily believe that a Jewish state should be where it is. Obviously, there is a Jewish connection to the land and where Israel is historically and biblically. I mean, that is undeniable. I say this as an anti-Zionist. There are Jewish traditions. There's been Jewish people in various numbers, not huge numbers, but for many, many, many years, well before Israel's existence. But anti-Zionism to me is a legitimate point of view. And in fact, before the establishment of Israel, it was quite uncommon for Jews in Europe to support the concept of a Jewish state. I mean, including my family.
Particularly religious Jews.
Indeed. They would say, I'm pretty comfortable in Europe, not to by any means diminish the reality of anti-Semitism, which existed. And in fact, that's obviously why the Zionist movement began in the late 1800s of many Jewish people in Europe saying, we will never be accepted as equal citizens. The only way this will change is a Jewish state. And obviously, that movement went from literally an idea in the late 1800s to within half a century, a reality, which clearly the Holocaust was undeniably a massive factor in that. But a lot of Jewish groups and Zionist groups these days are worried about the rise of anti-Zionism amongst young Jews and others, and therefore deliberately conflate it, saying the ADL, which is one of the largest so-called anti-discrimination groups in the US, Anti-Defamation League, has deliberately said, its leader said in the last years, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, equating someone like me with someone on the far right or a neo-Nazi. It's insane.
Yeah.
And that to me speaks more of desperation than anything else, that there is a growing realization amongst Jews and the non-Jewish public that what Israel has become, and maybe arguably always was, is a nation that proudly and openly discriminates against non-Jews, which I guess we'll get to. And therefore, it's to me a very logical thought that if you are Jewish, non-Jewish, that to me, any religious state, in my view, is discriminatory. I haven't got a particular issue with Israel because it's Israel. Yeah. I've said a lot in my last book, for example, on the Palestine Laboratory and elsewhere, that India, as one example, is increasingly becoming a Hindu fundamentalist state.
Yeah.
A deeply scary situation.
And I'd love to get to the reality of, on recording this, there has been an assassination of a Canadian citizen, and the Canadian Prime Minister has actually called that out publicly and said that India is responsible.
Yes.
And it's the technology that has been exported that you write about in your book, your most latest book, that actually makes that possible.
Yeah.
So I would love to pivot some to just that, but I really appreciate you mapping that for us, particularly with the majority of our listeners identifying as Christian. The history of anti-Semitism and Christianity can't be separated. The way that our sacred texts have actually been weaponized, that created the situation that I mean, the history of Zionism is that Jews who no longer would wait for Mashiach now, for the Messiah to return, said, we too desire a place where we don't live under the shadow of constant persecution that Christendom provided.
And yet, the irony that I say constantly is, it is more unsafe to be a Jew in Israel than virtually anywhere else in the world.
Yeah, flesh that out, Anthony, because I think that would surprise some listeners in hearing.
Well, on the one hand, yes, it's a Jewish state and you get many more benefits maybe there than in some other remote countries. But in terms of security and safety, there are far more. A lot of Israeli Jews feel insecure because of a range of reasons, justified or unjustified, because of possible neighbors, because of the fact that they, and again, I'm generalizing, but there's a great deal of racism against Palestinians, a fear of Palestinians. There's barely any engagement between Israeli Jews and Palestinians, unless you're an Israeli soldier in the West Bank who actually, so your engagement is through the military. So a Palestinian sees an Israeli Jew these days simply through the barrel of a gun, which obviously sets up a pretty toxic dynamic. And for the, yes, there is rising anti-Semitism in parts of the world, to be sure, but in general, if you're a Jew in the US or Australia, and I'm not minimizing the risk of Jews in certain places, chances are you are relatively secure and safe, which is different to how it was in the past. And I'm not suggesting there's not a rising threat. And one of the things that concerns me, I don't talk about a lot in the book, but I talk about it elsewhere, is that if we as a community, and frankly, many politicians and media do, is deliberately conflate anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism, then we're actually unable to fight real anti-Semitism, which that's is right. rising.
Yeah.
So I think that to me, and of course the Jewish groups that are pushing that are well aware of that. I mean, there's literally stories in the Israeli press, I read it every day for my sins, which talk about how the Israeli government itself under Netanyahu, and it wasn't that different when he wasn't in power, though he's been in power seemingly forever now, he's a real political survivor, is the Israeli government is openly partnering with far-right racists around the world. I mean, literally in the last month, the Israeli government is partnering with far-right Romanian political parties in Hungary and elsewhere, which have histories of associating with Nazism.
That's right.
Like, this is a Jewish state doing this.
Yeah.
Now, how does that not endanger all of us, Jew and non-Jew?
Yeah.
Which maybe perfectly pivots to the new book. I'm on record of saying that even though you identify as a Jewish atheist,
I should probably explain what that is, by the way, at some point, but go on.
Oh, yeah. particularly for Christians for whom cultural identity might not be as sociologically rich as it is for Jewish people. Let me give you an opportunity to do that first.
Yeah. I mean, the way I describe it, and I should preface it by saying, and maybe people on this podcast will find this bizarre, but I know a lot of people who describe themselves as Christian atheists or Muslim atheists, whether people accept that, I guess, is up to you guys to discuss. But I describe it as I don't have a religious faith. I don't believe in God. I guess don't believe in a higher power. However, I am proud of parts of Jewish culture, Jewish history. I think there's a real long tradition of Jewish descent. I think, sadly, much of that has been extinguished since the establishment of Israel, but that's a separate story. But I'm a supporter of the belief, you know, and I want to continue that Jewish tradition. And I suppose there's partly a sense of, for only 15 million Jews in the world, which is a tiny population, really, clearly not least because of the catastrophe of the Holocaust, I want to continue that line, so to speak, that Jewish population. So, yeah.
And it's you holding yourself and that tradition in such a way. I think your journalistic integrity, your bravery, your moral rigor shares more in common with the Hebrew prophets and those of us who claim those.
Yes.
Some of the greatness of the Jewish tradition is its ability to critique all forms of power, particularly power weaponized against the powerless. And Anthony, you clearly stand in that tradition and with this new book. So we'd love for you to sketch a little bit this new book, the project, and the importance for this moment in history.
I thank you so much for that, Jared. But I would say one of the things that enrages me, and the book only touches on this in brief, and I'll get to the book in a second, is I think that for so many in the Jewish establishment and community in the last 75 years, in fact, the way you describe the history of Judaism has completely collapsed. There has been, in my view, a moral collapse, a complete moral collapse. And again, as often I say, I'm generalizing. There are many exceptions to this. There are Jews who are speaking out, who are critical. I'm not the only one, of course. But this real sense that for many, many Jews, both those in the positions of influence, I'm talking about in the West, particularly US, UK, Australia, Europe, there has been an open acquiescence, very happy to support 110% Israeli occupation, Israeli policies. Because I was, and it comes down to the position that I was told years ago when I first started writing about this about 20 years ago, which was keep the dirty linen in private. Don't air our dirty linen in public. Right. And my response at the time, and I still feel it now, is you cannot be serious. You think that after decades and decades of an occupation that we in the Jewish community in the West have mostly supported, not me personally, but the Jewish establishment has supported, has led us to the moment now where we have literally in Palestine, which has been the case for years, but it's accelerating, Jewish-led pogroms against Palestinians. How do we think that happened? You think these settlers have suddenly appeared out of nowhere last week? Yeah. This is the cancer that's been eating at that state for decades that most of the Jewish community have either supported through their actions or their silence. I mean, that these things don't suddenly happen overnight. So the book, The Palestine Laboratory, really is an investigation into two things, particularly. One, how Israel's arms industry over really 75 years, but particularly in the last half century, has developed massive amounts of tools and technologies to repress Palestinians. And they're tested first on Palestinians in Palestine. So in the modern age, I'm talking about drones and spyware, facial recognition technology, biometric tools, all these kinds of things. And then Israel sells and promotes that as so-called battle-tested around the world. So there are huge amounts of nations around the world, democracies and dictatorships. In fact, the majority of nations in the world, I calculate over 130 nations on the planet, which is the majority of countries, have bought some form of Israeli repressive technology. Wow. And it goes to the heart, I think, of how a relatively small nation, Israel, with a tiny population, has become this huge global leader in repression. Yeah. And as someone who's Jewish, I mean, I'm not naive. I understand the arms industry. Many countries use it. The US, of course, being the most prominent. The US is 40% of the world's weapons sales. Israel is the 10th. So I'm not suggesting it's just Israel. So it's Russia, France, Germany. Everyone is bathed in sin on this issue in a way. But the difference is that Israel is, the two reasons why to me this is different. One, they claim to be a light unto the nations. They regularly say, we're a moral nation. We have the most moral army in the world. I mean, people might find this absurd to hear this now, but regularly, even today, Israeli officials and media say we have the most moral army in the world. How one can say that when you have an occupation in your backyard is insane. It'd be like the US military saying in Iraq and Afghanistan, sure, there were hundreds of thousands killed, but we did it morally.
Yeah.
They would laugh in their face, and rightly so. So it's partly a look at how that's happened. And secondly, a warning to people to say that Israel increasingly is the global leader, so to speak, in ethno-nationalism, this idea of a Jewish majority supremacist state that proudly prioritizes Jews over anybody else is deeply inspiring to many other nations and people who want to copy it in their own world. So India being the most obvious example, which is now the world's biggest nut country in population, roughly 1.5 billion people. China's population is going down because of their disastrous one-child policy in years past. So, and India's economy is not number one, but it could well be in the coming decades. Yeah. India is now run by Prime Minister Modi, who's a Hindu fundamentalist. Now, I'm not suggesting India is doing what's doing because of Israel. Of course not. They're doing it for their own dark reasons. But they're deeply inspired by each other. And I talk a lot in the book about that inspiration, how they're both inspiring each other in terms of discriminating against others. So, for example, Indian officials Indian officials regularly talk now about how much they're inspired by the occupation in Palestine, wanting to do something very similar in Kashmir, which is a Muslim majority part of India. And they're doing it. They're bringing huge amounts of Hindus to settle the land, literally. And apart from the fact India buys huge amounts of weapons from Israel. So that's part of it. And finally, as I touched on before, is this inspiration to the global far right. Now, on the one hand, that might seem incongruous. How could a Jewish state be inspiring far right fascists? I mean, far right fascists historically don't like Jews. Yeah. They could be Nazis. Like, what the hell is going on? And yet, if you go often to far-right rallies, and I only go there just to be clear for work, I don't go there to support them, to report on it, you often see the Israeli flag.
Mm.
And people often say, hang on, what is an Israeli flag for a Jewish state doing with it? Like, on January 6th, there are Israeli flags at regularly far-right rallies in Europe and elsewhere, including in Australia. And I think it's best summed up by, I touch on this in the book, a guy called Richard Spencer, who's a far-right so-called leader in America. And he called himself a white Zionist a few years ago. He goes, I'm a proud white Zionist. I love what Israel. No, he doesn't like Jews. Let's be clear.
Right.
But what he likes, he loves the idea that Israel is able to get away with prioritizing Jews over anybody else. And that's what he wants to create in his deluded worldview in America. A Christian ethno-nationalist fundamentalist state.
Wow.
And we are denying reality when we don't recognize the growing ties between the global far right that in some parts of the world are growing. India being one, Italy, Hungary, not everywhere, but in many places. And the country that's regularly held up as the model, the inspiration, is Israel. And that to me is both disturbing and also partly why I wrote the book as a warning for people to be aware of these connections and to fight against it.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. So you've touched, certainly in the United States, you already mentioned the ways in which, you know, the United States, its imperial activity is not a secret around the world and the harm that it causes. But I would be interested in hearing you talking a little bit more about the role that you see the U.S. playing, which I do think some of that, I mean, I can see it all the time in terms of white Christian nationalists and the kind of Zionism that exists in those movements here in the United States. And it's not strange to see anti-Semitism and Zionism side by side in some of these white nationalist Christian movements, right?
Yeah.
But even more thinking about U.S.'s role in supporting Israel's policies, how do you see that playing out, especially as you're thinking about this technological advance and deporting, porting out those technologies to other places.
I'll answer that in 2 seconds, but just to go back to one of the points you made a minute ago, one of the things that I've talked a lot about, and it's not in the book, but it's something that I'm thinking a lot more about recently, is that because Israel is so determined to expand its occupation in Palestine, the West Bank particularly, and there's now roughly with the West Bank and East Jerusalem about 750,000 Jewish settlers, the vision, so to speak, is 1 million, 2 million. But they're running out of Jews.
Yep.
There aren't enough Jews who want to go there. And one of the things I'm talking a lot about recently is I think we're not that far away, and it's happening already, that Israel starts accepting and inviting evangelical Christians to move there.
Yeah.
And now, is that going to be in millions of people? Maybe not. I don't know. but would they need to convert to Judaism? Maybe. And that's already started happening, by the way, in small numbers into the West Bank. And I mention that because you often hear increasingly in the US and in Israel amongst supporters of Israel, well, liberal Jews, we've kind of lost them. They're all squeamish about occupation. They should just toughen up or just bugger off, basically. However, our new fan base is white evangelicals. Now, again, it's interesting to note that I don't want to generalize. And in fact, there is a growing younger membership of that community, which is actually much more pro-Palestine. It's not black and white. However, the leadership in general is quite, you know, madly pro-Israel. You know, they go on sort of leadership tours to the wineries in the West Bank and help out the settlers during the summer, all that crazy stuff.
So
I don't think it's that far away to imagine that in years to come, those groups in large numbers may move there in some kind of deluded way of believing they're fulfilling God's mission. Right. In terms of the US role, I mean, the US is obviously, the US's role is I can't even put words into it. I mean, the US role is central, but I don't think Israel is doing all it's doing because of America, right?
Sure.
I think there's a real sense that, and this doesn't really matter, to be honest, who's in the White House. I think there's been a real mistake in the last sort of years, and this is not by any means to support Donald Trump, God help me, but it's similar with Netanyahu in Israel. The whole issue here is not two people. I mean, sure, Trump, you know, there are sometimes historical figures, and Trump to some extent is a historical figure, sadly, who for a variety of reasons can bring a, in my view, very dark movement together and be a figurehead. Netanyahu is the same thing. But Trump disappearing tomorrow, Netanyahu doesn't really change that equation, right? And in fact, what Trump was doing when he was president on lots of issues, frankly, was merely accelerating what was happening anyway. Because let's be clear, Biden's been in power for 2 years. On Israel-Palestine, nothing has changed. On the border with the US and Mexico, nothing really has changed, right?
That's right.
A lot of the so-called liberal press is less outraged about it now, which I think is a problem because what's happening is there is still huge amounts of abuses going on. Biden has not changed very much, as you guys would know. So I say that because I think it's worth remembering that, yes, the US role is vital. They provide huge amounts of money every year, support, aid support, military support. They provide diplomatic cover in the UN. They pretty much protect Israel from any kind of prosecution in the International Criminal Court. They sell them lots of weapons. America's role is vital. And in fact, it's interesting, there's a growing debate within the American right and the Israeli right of saying, we don't want this aid anymore. We don't need it. And actually, they're right. They don't need it. So if military aid from America stopped tomorrow to Israel, which it won't, but if it did, Israel would be just fine, in my view. They'd be fine. And there's a growing movement of saying, we don't want America meddling in our affairs, which is sort of bizarre in a way because America isn't. I mean, the fact that Joe Biden comes out now and then goes, oh, gee, those settlements not so good. You think Israel cares?
Yeah.
There's no, I mean, words, we're sort of at the stage now after half a century of occupation. Words are pretty cheap now. Yeah, I mean, to me, you either put political or financial pressure on someone or you're regarded as weak, because exactly how the US is viewed by many in the Israeli elites. So the US role is vital, but if the military aid stopped, and it's interesting, on the American right, there are some figures who do talk about stopping aid to Israel. I don't think it's going to be put forward by, say, Trump if he's the candidate next year, which is a fun prospect for everyone. We're very excited about that. But, and he could win, which is even more petrifying. But yeah, so the US role is vital, but it's not the only factor here, clearly.
Yeah.
Anthony, you use kindling to talk about not just the realities that I think many people will be informed of in terms of house demolition and deaths and the reality of the ongoing terrorization and trauma on a daily basis, simply trying to move on the land of your ancestors, but not merely the killing of people, but the killing of possibilities, political possibilities. My own journey with the issue of Palestinian sovereignty in the midst of occupation the first couple of years I met you, I was talking two state solution. You
so was used
Kimberling to
years ago.
And
we've all matured, Jeb. We've all matured since then.
Well, Jimmy Carter's book had a big impact on me.
It was a big book. It was a big book. Yeah.
And but the realities of there being no possibility of that anymore, I think, is a shock to many who haven't been on the ground and haven't heard or seen or lived amongst Palestinian people and seen their realities. And Kimberling has this particular phrase that describes this process and how it's actually being exported as well to other nations who are seeking to do the same thing. Would you share with us that term and the impact of what that means, not merely for Palestine, Israel, but for other realities?
You're talking about politicide, Jared, I presume you're talking about.
I am.
Yes,
yeah, yeah.
Yes. So it's a really, I do talk about that in the beginning of the book, and I'd encourage people if they're interested to read the book. It is called Politicide. It's written by Baruch Kimmerling, who's now passed away, but he was a very interesting Israeli academic and thinker. And the whole idea of it is not, obviously politicide sounds like genocide, but it's a little bit different. What he essentially means, and I don't want to put words into his mouth, and you could find his exact words in my book, but essentially what he says is that it's an attempt by Israel to extinguish, as you say, the possibility of any kind of change or progress. Now, it could be through violence. It often is through violence, ethnic cleansing, killing, house demolitions. It could actually be through simply extinguishing a political possibility of any kind of change, which is what Israel's done very successfully. And the point of exporting it is absolutely correct because, as I talk about a lot in the book, with weapons and other forms of surveillance, this is why the conflict in Palestine is not just about Palestine anymore. As bad as it is for Palestinians in Palestine, the whole concept of this is being exported. And as I say a lot, it's being exported both for financial gain, which is the obvious reason why people sell weapons, but it's actually more than that. I argued in the book, and I think Kimmerling would probably agree with it, it's also exploring the idea that you can get away with it. And that's in some ways not really something that you can sell, in a way, but a lot of countries around the world look at Israel and they say, we'd love a piece of that. And what I mean by that is we'd love to be able to repress our own dissidents, human rights activists, minorities, whatever it may be. And Israel gets away with it. I mean, who's stopping Israel? No, Israel is not random African country X, which far less power. That's obviously true. And I compare in the book a lot about South Africa during apartheid, where for those who don't know, Israel was one of its biggest fans, its biggest allies. And I think wasn't just because they were selling weapons. It was an ideological alignment.
Yeah.
That South African apartheid very much viewed Israel as an inspiration to how they were treating Palestinians, and Israelis regarded how South Africans were treating their black population, wanting to create something similar in both nations. And to some extent, I would argue they've done that. Now, obviously apartheid ended officially in 1994, although clearly it's actually just a very big story in a major outlet last week, which talked about, and I've read this before, and I've visited South Africa before. South Africa is in a bad place. There's just no doubt about that. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting they should go back to apartheid. Obviously, that was an undeniably good thing. It ended. But there's economic apartheid now. There's just no doubt about that. And it continues, and the ANC is corrupt, and it's a mess.
Yep.
But the connection between Israel and apartheid South Africa, the reason I spent a lot of time in the book talking about it is that it's relevant today. That relationship obviously ended when apartheid ended in 94, but it's relevant because it was ethno-nationalists joining together. And to me, the equivalent of that would be Israel, for example, and India, Israel and Hungary, the other countries I mentioned before.
Yeah.
And South Africa was frankly far less powerful nation than Israel was. And the challenge that activists had back then to end that, which is through boycott, divestment, sanctions, a range of other, you know, things that were done. The challenge for Israel to put pressure on them is far higher, in my view. I'm not saying impossible, but much more difficult. So the idea of extinguishing Palestinian hope, which I think Israel has attempted to do for a long time, on the one hand, you could say it succeeded because there's been no real progress politically for Palestinians. On the other hand, it's failed miserably because Palestinians have not gone anywhere. They're still there. You haven't got mass immigration. They're not leaving. I mean, even if some who could, they're not going anywhere. They, there's this belief that they will stay there. And when I say fight, I'm not saying necessarily always in a physical sense, but they will fight for their rights to remain there. And the fear that many of us have, and I talk a bit about this in the book, and I've been speaking a lot about it since the book came out, to sort of make people aware of it, is the fear that I have and others have is that there is a growing political tide within Israel for another Nakba, another mass ethnic cleansing. And this is not just a few fringe players in Israel. This is about literally leading Israeli politicians talking about, they say things like, we didn't finish the job in 1948. Now, in 48, for those who don't know, there was mass ethnic cleansing. 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly kicked out. And, of course, many Palestinians are still there. Of course they are. And this is where we're at today. And it's not just a handful of politicians. I quote in the book a survey from 2016, and I'm almost certain these figures would be far worse now, when close to half of Israeli Jews, nearly half, supported ethnic cleansing against Palestinians. We're not talking about a few bad apples here. That is a sizable amount of people. Yeah. Now, people often say, what does that mean? Practically, how would that work? What would be the so-called justification? Where would all these people go? Obviously, it's hard to know. I mean, I think neighboring Arab states that are frankly mostly in bed with Israel could be bribed to take them, mm-hmm. Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt. Why not? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the question really is, therefore, how does the world respond to that? We could say, oh, well, the world wouldn't accept that. To which I would say, really? So which part of the world wouldn't accept that? Well, the Arab countries are in bed with, exactly, in the world, and the Arab countries are in bed with Israel anyway, not the Arab people, the Arab countries. Yeah. The US's role would be a bit unclear. If it was Trump, frankly, God help us. Right. If it was someone like a Biden or a Democrat, and I'm not a fan of the Democrats, I'm not sure how they'd respond, frankly. Right. But that sort of, I think people should be aware that this is the growing, and not every Israeli Jew, of course, supports that idea. But when you have 7-8 years ago, nearly half believing it, I think a lot of people, this goes back to what you said earlier on, Jared, that I think for many in the West, Christian community, wider community, there's still this weird block of really coming to terms with the fact that Jews can be racist too, despite our history. I mean, obviously, like anyone, I mean, you know, there are good Jews and bad Jews. There's good people and bad people. I mean, it's sort of obvious to say that. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, this is the nature of humanity. But I think there is still a sense of, after all that Jews went through, how is that possible? How could you be like that? Well, the reality is on the ground. The evidence is overwhelming that there are a lot of people who see Palestinians as second-class citizens. I mean, it's not me saying it. The evidence is there, right?
Right. Yeah, no, that's good. You know, I just said last week we had Robert P. Jones speaking at events for us locally, and he's married to a progressive Jew. And someone asked him in the conversation during the Q&A, you know, well, how can we, as we're having these conversations, learn from Jewish communities on this? And he answered, and he basically said, you know, like, there's a rich tradition of activism and work around racial justice here in the United States by some Jews. And also there was a lot of problematic stuff that we don't like to talk about a name, right? That's also a part of that story. And we've got to kind of sort through. And so not everyone was Heschel, right? You know, there was also other folks that actually perpetuated a lot of really. And so it's that complex humanity.
I mean, then and now, right? I mean, people often say the Jewish community was central to the civil rights movement in the US. And yes, there were some Jewish groups that were central. Obviously, the black community was the ones pushing it, clearly. But yeah, there were some Jewish groups that undeniably were part of that. But the many who weren't, of course, like any people, they have their own feelings, agendas, ideas, racism, humanism, whatever it may be. I mean, it's like saying South Africa, there are some Jews who were very much against apartheid, but frankly, the majority had no problem with it in South Africa. There was no problem. I had no issue with it. It was totally fine.
Anthony, this goes to one of your initial insights in our time together, when you talked about how far does our imagination stretch when we talk about neighbour. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, one of the fascinating things about the nation state of Israel is that it started as a socialist experiment that only stretched so far. So whether it's a religious imagination or whether it's like Zionism itself was a vision of socialism for a particular people that were bound together
or Jews
ethnically. That's right.
For Jews alone.
how incredibly dangerous that becomes for all of us when compassion, solidarity, and only stretches for us, and us is defined over and against constantly a them, which in a weird way brings us back to the text that you opened up for us initially. In light of what you have dedicated your life to as a journalist, the truth-telling that has meant that you have been in positions that are incredibly dangerous as you've sought to share with the wider world the realities of some of the things that are going on. As you read Ecclesiastes 3 and you hear this poetry, this ancient poetry, what does it evoke in you? What things does it bring up for you that you might think are of interest for us?
Yeah, I'm just looking at the quote again now. I mean, one of the things that it says to me is that we are, in my view, very much at a time of needing to heal. And when I say we, I mean the general world, but I guess particularly in the Jewish community. And I say that because there is, although, you know, what gives me some hope, I'll answer that full question in a sec, Jared, but what gives me some hope is there has been a shift in the last 10 years or so of many in the Jewish community, particularly younger Jews in the US and elsewhere. There is what I call it a Jewish insurgency within the Jewish community that it doesn't get huge amounts of press, although I think it should. In the US, it's very visible. It's no longer possible to say there's a Jewish consensus on Israel because it's frankly bollocks. It's not true. I mean, the Jewish establishment will say there is, but there isn't. So you have groups like Jewish Voice for Peace in the US, If Not Now, mostly founded by younger Jews, although anyone can join, of course. They're doing activism. They're often anti-Zionist. They support BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanction. They're trying to, I mean, do things like humanize Palestinians. I mean, you know, meet Palestinians, which should not be that radical. Right. But for some people it is. I didn't meet a Palestinian when I was growing up. I have no recollection of meeting any Palestinians until I was, I have no idea when, maybe my 20s. I just didn't meet any.
Wow.
Not because it was kept away from me deliberately. I mean, I guess you could say I didn't have much initiative. I guess that's on me, but it just wasn't as common, I suppose. And it's also more difficult now. I grew up in a, showing my age here, before the internet, so it's more difficult to reach out to people, you know, back in the old days. but yeah, I think there is a certain, I think there is a real sense of needing to both heal the community, but also bring accountability to the community. And that's to me what I see that quote is very much about saying, I see my role and others as putting pressure on elements of a Jewish community who are deeply complicit in the catastrophe that is happening in our name in Israel and Palestine. And I think to some extent, I'm aware that certain Palestinian friends of mine are often frustrated that their voices don't get as much traction as they undeniably should. And there is something about some of the media preferring, for a range of reasons, sometimes racism, sometimes other reasons, a sort of Jewish voice to talk about this issue when Palestinian voices just as much right to talk about it. Of course they do. That I think it's, and again, my whole life is not simply attacking the Jewish establishment, but part of it is saying that you are responsible for what is going on, because without Jewish diaspora support, there would not be an Israeli occupation, in my view. It's undeniable.
Wow.
And also to show to the wider community that there is not just one Jewish view. I mean, I've been writing about this issue for 20 years and lots of other issues too. And I still get huge amounts of messages from people either saying, wow, we didn't know there was more than one Jewish view on this issue, which might sound ridiculous in a way, but a lot of people don't know because the media still very much prioritizes, with some exceptions, and it is changing, the so-called Jewish establishment view, which is Israel right or wrong. So partly that, and also just the idea that the Jewish community historically has had that diversity, but there's been such an attempt to knock that out of the community since Israel's birth, to have apparent unity as seen as a benefit that we can advocate better for Israel if we're united, where I would say, where has that unity got us? That so-called unity has got us to a situation in 2023 where there is a proud apartheid state that commits pogroms against Palestinians backed by elements of the state. Is that what we're supposed to be proud of as Jews in 2023? 75 years odd after the Holocaust? That to me is the worst legacy imaginable. But that's basically where we're at, I would argue. So to me, finding a way to both heal but also uproot those, in my view, malicious forces are important, and finding a new generation younger than me to build that community. And that is what's happening to an extent with Jewish Voice for Peace and others. In the years, people can find those groups online easily, and they do some wonderful work.
They do.
Yeah, that's so good. I appreciate that interpretation on this text, because, so many Christian communities like to talk about it, Kairos, is the kind of season we're in, what time it is, right? Mm-hmm. And in the Black church, it's often said, especially in the movement, it's always time to do what's right, And I think it's always been time to be committed to that kind of healing, to that kind of uprooting of injustice, to protecting those who are most vulnerable. And I think it's about waking up to what time it is, and hopefully inviting other people to join in into that work.
Yeah.
So it's really powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Talking time, Anthony, you've been incredibly generous with yours. In terms of the podcast proper, we're about to press pause after you share where people can find, sign up to your mailing list and find your resources and books and all the rest. But if you're willing to, those who have gathered from around the world, we might spend a little bit of time in Q&A for those who financially support Patreon. Thanks, mate. So please do tell us, where can people follow your work?
So basically, I'm on all the social media apps for my sins. You can find my website, anthonylowenstein.com. You can get my book pretty much in any, hopefully, bookshop. You can find. I would encourage people not to support Amazon, because I'm not a big fan of that company, although it's ubiquitous in our lives. But, local bookshops, independent bookshops, if you haven't got it there, ask them to order it in for you. It should be available widely in the US, UK, Australia, globally, online. So, yeah, and I really appreciate the conversation. And I'm seeing some people here have said lovely things. So thank you all for listening.
The Inverse podcast is proudly supported by you, the listener. And if you want to join the revolutionaries who are helping us have conversations about how this ancient text can still turn the world upside down, why don't you head over to patreon.com/inverse.